Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, JD, Blake, and Ailish. That's Wager Week here at Sportsnet. So we're starting things off. Everybody's got a million gambling questions for us. Everybody's transferring over the accounts.
And the text line, too. Everyone's like,
everybody,
where do I get my money? Including me.
Hey, listen. Yeah, including you. Yeah, everyone's trying to navigate this world of legal sports betting, okay? We're all just trying to figure out where we stand as of today with our bets, what got voided, what got cashed, what information we need
to
get out.
What I don't understand is how do people have all these questions when sports betting wasn't legal until today? I had never placed a bet before.
You know,
so
what?
I don't really understand.
It wasn't illegal either, is the thing. Like, that's the weird one about
Very complicated to get your money.
Yeah. It was.
Especially when you lose a lot.
Yeah. I don't know.
Not
how
us.
I know that I won my bet on the Wake and Rake this week.
Yeah, you're alone, pal.
I was the only one?
Yeah, that was typical of last week.
Yeah, I was 4-5 last week.
All right, it's a new week. It's wager week. It's now
four and
it's
one.
Legal.
We got to get you to stop saying was... 4-5 because it sounds like you're saying 4 wins, 5 losses.
I know. I'm so mad
you went
at that.
4-1.
I know. I don't, because I always visualize it as the 4-5, right? Yes. I don't visualize it like a record in, like, I went 4-1.
But you're suing yourself.
I know, I sue myself every time. Thank God my numbers guy, Blake, is here. Blake is just basically there to guide me to the correct things, like, 90% of the time. Where I go, here's what something is.
Yeah.
No,
although the last couple weeks, the last 2 weeks, since Ailish came back, basically, I have not been able to guide myself to... Extra frustrating because I had a really good NBA week this week.
I'll just take another week off.
I was just a disaster. Yeah,
I'll stick another. No, you're done with your weeks off. You're here. You're here to stay. Look at you. This is the thing. You have the sunshine coming into the apartment.
Yeah.
Your apartment and the sunshine that comes around this time as always makes me feel like I live in a different country. I look out into over my balcony and it's dreary and dark and I don't understand how it operates in your part of town versus mine. Whatever. We're moving on. The Maple Leafs, they beat the Flyers. Who cares? Honestly, like, if you're going to take much from that game, I don't know what you're supposed to take outside of they're much better than the Flyers. And yet it was weird because they actually didn't play a very good game. They just out-talented them. Jack Campbell comes back, though, and he looks pretty good. He lets in the 3 goals, but none of them are, oh, no, Jack, you had to make that. Looked athletic, made that one glove save on the scramble that everyone was kind of posting and reposting, saying, hey, Jack is back, blah, 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 blah. But the Jack test really comes tonight. It's the Tampa Bay Lightning. It's not your Philadelphia Flyers. It's a team that you are not going to be favored against. And then there's going to be a back-to-back, and Shalgren, I'm assuming, is going to play. Mm-hmm. They're probably not going to push Jack Campbell for back-to-back starts at this point of the season. Hard to envision that ever happens down the stretch here. But, yeah, you've got the games against the two Florida teams, two measuring stick moments for the Toronto Maple Leafs. So the way I'm going to set this up is I'm looking at this through the lens of Jack has a bit of a grace period right now in that I'm not going to be freaking out if Jack Campbell lets in a bad goal tonight against Tampa, okay? He just got back from an injury. If we're talking about the reason why he fell out of his play earlier this year was due to a lack of rhythm, then I'm going to at least apply some measure of that when we're looking at his games right now. Jack needs to look right to me the last week going into the playoffs, maybe 2 weeks going into the playoffs, where I feel very, very confident about his play. Right now, I just want to see signs of health, not re-injury, and not 5 bad goals against, right? Like, not a disaster night. You guys don't have to frame it that way. So you can either disagree or agree with Jack being the story of tonight. But if you're looking at it through my lens of Jack gets a bit of a grace period, what is the thing you care most about tonight in terms of a sign from the Leafs, Ailish Forfar?
Okay, so the Jack thing is certainly one of them, especially playing against a goaltender like Vasilevsky, where let's say you're a goaltender, you know who you're matching up against, and you push yourself to be the better goaltender in the game, and that is one of the biggest opportunities for him to come out and to hang with the best, or one of the best in the league. So certainly what Jack Campbell does tonight is of high importance, but I look at it as an opportunity for the top players on the Maple Leafs to outshine the top players on the Lightning. And if you're going to pretend that this is a playoff series, that needs to be a very significant matchup where the Leafs override them. I think if we're looking at matchups this postseason, each team has an all-star line that they could be playing against, and the Maple Leafs have a lot of talent as well. It's not like, okay, let's out-muscle the Philadelphia Flyers. Let's out-muscle one of the best in the league. So I look at what the top line or two can do to solidify that they are elite, and they're elite against the best of the best. And they have been. They've been showing that in some of the opportunities they've had over the last couple of weeks. Like, they're playing real teams now. They're playing the best of the best. So if the Leafs can come out and have their all-stars have an all-star night, I think that that bodes really well for what's going to happen in the playoffs, or what could.
I'm totally with you. It's what I care about the most. My only thing, I guess, where we maybe fracture or split a touch is I trust the Matthews-Marner-Bunting line. If they don't show up in the postseason, I'm not viewing that as a, oh, we found out that they weren't as good as they are because they were playing top teams. No. It'll be a choke, flat out. Mm-hmm. It'll be a choke, or it'll be extremely bad luck. Because
I also think that this is, but it's like a little bit of a confidence boost too, yep, for them. Like, hey, you're going to go in and own the Tampa Bay Lightning, and you just beat the Florida Panthers, and you just beat the Boston Bruins. Like, think of that momentum going into the playoffs. Like, we have done it, and we've done it recently, and we can continue to do that in the playoffs.
Yep. And they're going to have a stretch here again where they're playing multiple teams and they're doing that. I just think, mm-hmm, like, you have a sample now of Matthews, Marner, Bunting that is so undeniably good, and that has already been proven to be looking great against certain good teams, that even if they had a bad night against Tampa, I wouldn't be sort of overreacting to it going, oh boy, I don't think that those guys could dominate against Tampa Bay. You're right. I definitely want to see it. It definitely matters to me. But where I'm looking at it with top players, Ailish, is the other two lines. All of a sudden, Tavares is playing better. He's actually got 15 points in his last 14 games, and he's scoring goals again, which, if you remember, he had 14 games without a goal, and we were all going, what the hell is going on?
Remember.
Could you ever
trade him?
Right. He's now over a point a game over this last stretch. And again, I think he has 7 goals in that span. He's been playing incredibly well. And now the Leafs feel like they have three lines because Nylander's going extremely well. Like, the game against the Flyers, if you want to have a take, it's that the Nylander line was the best of them. And I can't wait to talk with Bourne about this later as to why this is working out in this certain way. But for those of us like myself and, like, I believe the two of you that were clamoring for splitting up Tavares and Nylander, so far this small pool of results has been a pretty strong indicator that this is a correct decision. But it's hard to measure it against the Philadelphia Flyers because who cares? I do expect that William Nylander in advantageous matchups against a bad hockey team should play very well. What is it going to look like tonight against the Tampa Bay Lightning? How is the Nylander line, how is the Tavares line going to look against much better competition? And that, I think, applies to both of these games. So it'll probably carry over to tomorrow's narrative as well, which is the Florida Panthers are built in a way where they have three lines. The Tampa Bay Lightning, three lines. Do the Leafs have three lines? I know Toronto's top line can show up and dominate against anybody on any given night. And if you slow them down for one night, they're probably going to come through the next one. The next two lines are huge question marks to me. Massive. Completely unproven. I would even argue it's almost as unproven as just about anything, including the D pairings right now. So let me see John Tavares play with force. Let me see William Nylander play with force against two really good teams, but specifically champions in Tampa Bay, that I'm guessing will take this game quite seriously.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm with you guys on that. I think the ability for those lines to go up against a, hey, let's see how you handle Stamkos, Cirelli, Killorn, or whatever that iteration ends up being. Even Hagel, Paul, Colton has been a pretty heavily used group for them post-deadline. So let's see how you stack up against that. You know, I would still put Jack kind of front of mind for me personally. And it's not, there is a grace period, JD. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's more of a, not competency, but like a floor test, where he had 5 straight games before he went on the shelf with like dramatically sub 900 save percentage in those games. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he allowed 3 goals on Saturday, but hey, that was on 32 shots. I just need that, right? Like, this team should be offensively potent enough, even against top teams, that's okay. You don't need, like, it was awesome when Jack was playing like a 920, 925 goalie start in the season. I don't think you need that necessarily. You need, yeah, Jack to be stable, and if he can be in the 905 to 910 range for a little bit here, I think that gives you a little bit of extra confidence heading in. But yeah, these next two games, we've talked about it all year, right? Like, oh, it doesn't matter till the playoffs, and you can't do that for 82 games. But the schedule is like favorably in terms of evaluating this team. The schedule is a lot tougher this last little bit. They had a couple of those games last week, came out looking good. They have a couple of them this week. Let's see how you look again. And then on top of that, like, let's not lose that this is a pretty tight standings battle right now too. Mm-hmm. If you care about something like home ice advantage in the first round, this game tonight is massive because they're tied in the standings. So I think there are a lot of little things. There's not one overarching thing I'm pulling out of this. But I want to see this is a really good test this week.
Yep, it really is. And I agree with Jack about the floor. Again, like, if he looks disastrous over the next couple of games, it's kind of hard not to freak out a bit about that.
Yeah, and there's no solution, right? Like,
no, there's nothing that you can turn to. I guess my greater point with the grace period was that I've got to believe, at least you're right, that the floor is there, but I'm not going to be evaluating every goal the way that we were before his injury, where we were going, holy crap, another one like this, Jack, another one like that, Jack. That the grace period more has to do with the ceiling, I guess, is the way to put it, where you're saying, hey, man, you can let in a bad goal every single night right now without us absolutely blasting you and killing you, because we all know that you've got to be able to get there, and that for him... I kind of do look at it through, hey, you. Now it is call me when the playoffs start time, right? Like, these games, these mm-hmm. measuring sticks moments are only really going to feel relevant because they're ways of feeling out what it's going to look like in the postseason. I would say that right now it's kind of hard to watch games against the Flyers because it just doesn't feel at all important. Like, that's how I felt watching that last Flyers game is, boy, like, I'm really stretching
the biggest story of that game
something.
Was, oh, Keith Yandel's Iron Man streak.
Exactly, which...
Which was crazy.
Why did they do that? Like, honest, I get, you know, we talked a little bit about how there's an easy win for the player, our Department of Player Safety, where someone gets sucker punched from behind and hurt. Just suspend the player for a game seems pretty simple. And for the Flyers, they go, we need to evaluate players. Oh, why? Just play Keith Yandel. Just don't be healthy.
They're in basically last place.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Who cares?
And against the Leafs, too, on a Saturday night where it's going to be so incredibly visible. It would have been throughout hockey anyways, but just the idea of you doing on Hockey Night in Canada, it rubbed me the wrong way. I think that the Flyers, it's like breaking a window. You get 7 years bad luck. Like, there's going to be some resonance from that karmic yeah. decision for the Flyers.
And he was so close. Like, shut him down after he gets to 1,000. What are you doing?
No, it's stupid. It was unbelievably stupid. Okay, so I agree with Jack. I agree with the forward lines. Again, how do you look? Do you have the best line tonight, Ailish, to your point, against a team that has point Stamkos and Kucherov? Can you elevate against these guys? It's going to matter. Can your goaltending look competent? The other story from the weekend is Jake Muzzin is moving around. He's not just moving around. He's hitting people at practice. He doesn't have the non-contact jersey on anymore, which means that he's not going to go tonight, but looks like it's going to be very, 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 very soon. Jake Muzzin comes back. We've seen these pairings look pretty solid as of late. And I wonder if either of you feels a little bit more, has any more conviction as to where he should slot into the lineup.
I would say give him a little bit of a period of integration, which is just what we were talking about with Jack Campbell. I think low expectations. I think you don't want to jump in and have something happen. We've talked a lot about his injury concerns, especially with a head injury. Mm-hmm. But the decor has been looking really solid and the partners are looking really confident together. So the good thing is you have like eight defensemen now all of a sudden that could be potential lineups. Like, we didn't think that Liljegren was going to be good. Now he's like an elite defenseman. So I am a little bit worried about shaking it up, but at the same time, you know, I think Jake Muzzin can be an impact player come the playoffs. So they have what, 2 weeks to kind of taper him in and give him that opportunity. I would just be worried about throwing him right in and having something significant happen. So it is a bit of a concern, but at the same time, it's kind of a good problem to have.
Yeah, it's a tough one because the things are working right now, right? Like, Riley, Lyubushkin looks good. I mean, Giordano and Liljegren looks amazing. but yeah, there's an element here of, what do you do if something stops working in a playoff series or down the stretch, or if another injury comes up? Like, you have to work Jake Muzzin in because he's Jake Muzzin and it raises the ceiling of your potential decor. But I think you also need to, as much as once they broke up Gio and Liljegren and it looked bad, And then they went back to it. It's like, oh, yeah, that works. You know, you do have to juggle a little bit here and see who Muzzin fits within the new dynamic. I don't know about you guys. I feel like Labushkin's probably the guy I've downgraded the most since the 100%. Deadline. In terms of
he's out.
Who might be the next guy out. And I'm sure they'll rotate it around just to keep everyone in the mix and stuff and try different pairings. But yeah, I don't know. And the huge question for me is, if Sandin were to be ready in time, how does that work? Because he was one of their top three defensemen before he went down. So I don't really know what to make of it other than I'm juggling. I probably give Muzzin the crack at Brody again just to see if that's there. I know the Brody pairing's been good so far, but I probably want to shelter Muzzin a little bit or give him that help a little bit coming in. So I don't have
that. Sorry, continue.
I was just going to say, I would juggle it around a little bit. I gotta see what Muzzin looks like at this point.
I will say that one of the things that we talked about as a negative throughout the last, couple months was that nobody was playing consistently together. I will say that if something transpires where lines aren't working in the playoffs, that can actually be something that is a positive. You've played with multiple people, you've created a little bit of chemistry. The lines haven't been set until recently, so the defense played with basically everybody for a couple months there. If I'm looking at something that might be a positive, if the Leafs can't, you know, find a little bit of chemistry in the playoffs, is shaking it up might actually be an okay option. Hopefully that isn't the case, but they did basically do that for 3 months.
Yeah, I think this is a no-brainer. I'm sitting Labushkin and I'm putting the Riley Brody pairing back together. You know that works. And you need those guys to be, like, you trust both those guys to be playing over 20 minutes, and you can trust them to play in any situation. That's it, all of this has kind of confused us from the standpoint of, like, the injuries forced them into a position where they had to break those guys up, right? Poor play is what forced those guys to break up. They had to kind of circle around and figure things out, and the byproduct of that has been a positive one, right? You found out that Brody and Hall can play together. You found out upon acquiring Giordano that he and Liljegren can play together. You know, historically, that Giordano and Brody should be able to have some chemistry with one another. Like, you now have the benefit, Ailish, of the thing that you talked about, which is by shaking things up if you need to or if you want to take a different look, you have a sample of something. But to me, this is very, very straightforward. This is very simple. This is not an overthink for the Toronto Maple Leafs. I'm worried that they don't do it this way, but I think that it's a layup. It's an absolute layup. Riley and Brody back together. Muzzin and Hall back together. You're not messing with Giordano and Liljegren. And yes, are there the odd nights where maybe you're going to end up cycling in Labushkin to take a look at what it is with him and Giordano, and one night Liljegren ends up sitting? Sure, but I'm not... That's the best version of this team that I see right now moving forward. I'm not factoring in Sandin right now because he's too far with the injury, right? Once he gets closer to health, then we'll have that conversation. But as of right now, with these seven defensemen, Labushkin is the worst of them. He's the guy that is not playing up to the snuff of Justin Hall. Hall's been way better lately. You're not pulling him from the lineup for Labushkin right now. I think we all felt as though at one point in the year that was going to be the natural progression for this team, was that he was going to replace a lot of what Hall wasn't giving them and what Hall was supposed to be giving them. But as of right now, that's it. Put your number one pairing back together. Give Muzzin back his guy in Hall that he has a history with and started out slow, but see if the two of them have kind of readied the ship a bit. Muzzin with the extra rest and the lack of wear and tear on the tires, Hall with a little bit of rejuvenation that's been going on with him over the last month, and then, of course, like I said, Giordano and Liljegren, I just don't see any reason why you're going to mess that up right now or why you're going to split those guys up or how you could think that there's a different pairing that looks like a better option right now. So Sheldon Keefe, that's the game plan in front of you as of right now. And then, yeah, mix in Labushkin to make sure that he's still feeling healthy and ready, maybe on a back-to-back to alleviate something from a Liljegren or whatever in more physical matchups.
A little bit of competition on the back end's a good thing. You know, as I said, eight comparable defense, Labushkin being kind of that odd man out, a little bit of competition really helps, I think, in practice and getting yourself back in there for the playoff race. You know, I think it kind of worked with Simmons. I don't know if that's a bit of a stretch, but hey, we are talking about for a while saying that Is he the odd man out and he has a really good game? Maybe that's a little bit of a, hey, I got to prove myself, and that could help with the decor. So good problem to have, I think.
So we've done, like, it's a cliche to say it, but you're probably going to need more than six defensemen for the playoffs. It's like with starting pitching, we always go, you're going to need more than five starters. Yes, we get it. God, it's just, this is not an astute point you're making. It's an obvious one. But yeah, if you look at the Leafs in years past, when they were pulling in Marincin, versus this year where you could be potentially pulling in Sandin and Lyubushkin, it's a pretty terrific place. I don't think the Leafs blue line has ever been better. Under the Kyle Dubas slash go back to what we could just call it, the Austin Matthews era, I guess. The Austin Matthews era, they've never had a better blue line. They've never had a more complete blue line. They've never had a deeper blue line. They've never had a more balanced blue line. It's not one of the core issues of the team right now. It used to be. It was a talking point, talking point, talking point. Blue line, blue line, blue line. Team defense, team defense, team defense. We're talking about the goaltending the way that we are because we're saying you don't need to come up with the spectacular saves. You don't need to be bailing this team out night in, night out. You just need to be competent because the team obviously has the right pieces in front of you. All right. You got pieces. Maybe you get pieces in your teeth. It's time for something to chew on. Brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
So just a quick one here, and this one's kind of for a buddy of mine who's been a Mitch Marner pessimist, even as he's been on this unbelievable season.
They still exist.
So they do still exist. So this is what I want to chew on with you guys today.
Mitch, I like Marner, how you're going to settle a petty grievance with a one-way microphone with your friend.
It's not a petty grievance. This is a okay. Check for me of, am I too optimistic, or is this jabroni back in Cambridge too pessimistic? So Mitch Marner has 81 points in 59 games this year. He has 60 in his last 33. Obviously, the book on Marner has been, yes, he's been a point-a-game guy during his Leafs career, but he's struggled in the playoffs. 25 points in 32 games in the playoffs, and the bulk of those came in one really strong playoff series. His four other playoff appearances, he's had 4 points in each of them. So there's a concern there. I went through his splits and his game logs. Against the other nine teams in the top 10 in the NHL this year, Marner has 23 points in 16 games. This is not a Marner's beating up on the bad teams. And yes, he had a couple points against Philly, but that's not this. With the exception of Calgary, he has put up points and played well against every other team in the top 10, including some great games against Boston, Carolina, Florida, Pittsburgh, Tampa. We'll see more tonight and tomorrow, obviously. But the something to chew on here is just, are we past the Mitch Marner, not pessimism, but caution level in terms of optimism? Because I'm ready to believe that this is a version of him that's going to carry over.
No. I'm
no to which part?
I think that, no, we can't be past the pessimism point because we've seen this in terms of, like, I actually look at Siakam. And I think there's a bit of a parallel here in terms of your incredible regular seasons. Are you going to carry this over into the postseason? Is there any sign of... No, you have more signs that it's going to work out. Right now, Siakam looks like an evolved player. And it looks like his confidence is in a better place than it ever has been before. The issue with Mitch Marner has always been, from a lot of different people, that the physicality of the playoffs and the tightening of the playoffs is much like when you are the defensive assignment number one of a team and they decide to take you away, that we always seem to underestimate a little bit how that can affect guys. And so I guess going into this, seeing what happened to Mitch Marner last year, Siakam has had time removed from his series against Boston, right? Like, it's been over a season now. He's played two seasons.
And it only happened to him once.
Exactly. It happened one time, and it was a season removed ago. And he has improved, and it was also like, this dude actually might have gotten hit by the pandemic worse than anybody else. Like, really, there were factors to Siakam's that I think were a little bit more understandable. As great of a player as Marner is, and I really do believe he is a great player, the degree to which he was shook up last year, the degree to which he seemed to be haunted by his inability to have success and to overcome. Remember, Kyle Dubas pulled him into his office during the playoff series, for God's sakes. He was absolutely eviscerated by Leafs fans and the press and could not get anything going and was taking, let's not forget, the over-the-glass penalties in which he led the league more than any other player in the postseason over his stretch by a pretty healthy margin. You can't forget the look on his face when he was in that penalty box. His body, the way that he carried himself in that series. I'm really rooting for Mitch Marner. All of us are. And do I think it's more likely than not, Blake, that he just rolls into the postseason and he's a dominant figure? I do. I think that if this is a balance of probabilities, Marner is going to be fine, and that we look at the clutch stuff in a way that we often do with the great athletes, right? Which is we question whether they're clutch, and then it turns out to be a sample size thing. And eventually David Price ends up with what should have been a World Series MVP after being called not clutch his entire career, right? So balance of probabilities, Marner ends up being great. But if you have questions about it and you have concerns about it, I don't think that he can ever do something in a regular season that's going to convince some people that automatically this is going to work out. So it's a little bit of both, but like I also have more faith he's going to be good, but I also am completely there with, hey, we don't know how this works for athletes sometimes. And yeah, if Marner doesn't come out of the gate strong, if they lose the first game and he's a dash two, or they lose the first two games or two of the first three and he has 1 point and it's a secondary assist or a primary assist, how is that going to build up on his shoulders? Like, how is he going to be able to deal with that? And how are teams going to treat him with the physicality of a postseason series and how he holds up against that? So I think there are still very real questions when it comes to Marner. And again, as great of it as a regular season it's been, you can't answer them right now.
You can't. And we're going to see how an opponent prepares for you is always the huge factor in a playoff series. The huge factor on the PGA Tour this week might be, how do you adjust your game when an unexpected opponent gets dropped into the mix and he gets all the media attention? It looks like he's been doing the shoulder days and the bicep and tricep days, getting ready for a potential return. Tiger Woods, maybe on the way back. We're going to talk to Bob Herrig, golf writer at Sports Illustrated, about Tiger's potential return later this week. That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan.
Breaking down the top stories in the NHL every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody's favorite events, Masters. A couple weeks ago, I don't even know if it was a couple weeks ago, maybe it was a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, three of us had a conversation about Tiger Woods and the reports of him wanting to go and the reports of him getting close. And I think I told the two of you, like, there's just no way that it's this
year. It was last week on the A-list, and you were like, there's no way.
Of course I said there's no way. Tiger Woods is 46 years old. And, his injuries were so severe that I actually had to Google multiple times to be sure that the accident was last year. Right? Because again, pandemic time, you're never really sure. And I went, oh, maybe Tiger Woods was injured way before I thought he was. I thought it was February 2021. That was my thought process of when this injury was. No, it was. It was February 24th, 2021, where he suffered injuries that were so bad that he needed to be stabilized by inserting a rod into his tibia. And he had injuries to the bones of his foot and ankle that were repaired with screws and pins. And they had to remove coverings of muscles to reduce the pressure of some of the swelling.
13 months ago.
13 months ago. 46 years old. If you recall, November 21st was the day he put out a video where he was doing some chipping. On the 29th, he had an interview with Golf Digest that really did sound like a retirement speech, where I did a show and discussed it about how this is sort of the real moment of us realizing that we're never going to see that version of Tiger Woods again. He talked about being selective with his events and having already climbed his Mount Everest. Go on down the line. Here we have it now, where he's announcing that he's a game time decision for Augusta and has once again captivated the golf world and is once again asking us what is possible with Tiger Woods. To discuss it further with us, it's Bob Herrig, golf writer, Sports Illustrated, and author of Tiger, Phil, Golf's Most Fascinating Rivalry, which, of course, it comes out very, very soon, April 26th, so you can pre-order it right now on Amazon. I know I will be doing that. Bob, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So the announcement comes as, I don't want to say a shock to me at that point, because it had been building at least for a day or two, the possibility of this happening. But what were the conversations like around the golf world about Tiger's potential? When did this start to become a feeling like this was going to be a reality to you?
Not until last Tuesday. when he came up here to play a practice round at Augusta. I mean, yeah, there had been a little bit of chatter about this, you know, maybe for a few days before that, going into the weekend. But 2 weeks ago today, I would have said no chance. I mean, I was with you. I just heard what you were saying. And, you know, 13 months ago, 14 months ago is when he was in this horrific crash. And while some of his comments, he might have been just lowering expectations and, you know, trying not to get people's hopes up, or maybe not even his own. You know, it's just ridiculous to think that he might be trying to play in a tournament this week. You know, I saw him briefly yesterday when he arrived. We weren't allowed to go on the course, but he you know, was hitting balls, and, you know, he looks good. It's obviously the walking part is the mystery. Mm-hmm. Can he handle it for 2, 3, 4 days? But yeah, I just don't think you can overstate, you know, how difficult this is. And to be honest, if it weren't the Masters right now,
yeah,
I doubt we'd see him for a while. I think it's because it's such a special event. You know, like, he wouldn't be rushing back to play a regular event this week.
No.
You know, and if, you know, and he might not play again for another 2 months after this. So, but still, I think it's incredible to even, you know, if he even tees off Thursday, I think that's amazing.
It really is. Again, I cannot get over it. And it's funny talking to hardcore Tiger fans, like some of my friends, because they go, of course you can do it, man. Of course Tiger did it. But I'm going, guys, he's 46. He's 46 years old. To come back from this is nuts. And again, like, I think we saw something, a quote from him fairly recently, where he was talking about the foot, how the foot still doesn't feel right. But is that to you, like you said, you saw him, that this isn't going to be an issue with his swing? It's primarily and almost all focused on whether or not his foot can hold up through walking and putting pressure over it over those 4 days.
No question. This is completely different than the other injuries he's come back from where the golf swing was impacted.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a bad back, you're going to compensate for the swing. The same with a left knee injury, which, believe it or not, the left leg is worse in this situation than the right. Now, he's going to have to compensate also for the right side, but it's probably a little bit easier to deal with than anything else. The pain is not in the golf swing. The pain is everything else. And, you know, I've got it from people, oh, you know, it's golf, it's just walking, what's the big deal? I mean, you know, the ignorance of that is stunning to me. Walking, I challenge anybody who's just even in average shape to walk Augusta National just once and see how they feel afterward. If you're perfectly healthy, you know, forget about hitting the shots off weird lies, standing around waiting. You're on your feet for 5+ hours. You've warmed up for 45 minutes before. I mean, you're talking about 6-7 hours on your feet. And what does he have? A really bad right foot. You know, it's just kind of ludicrous to think it's no big deal. It's a big deal. It's going to be difficult. And, you know, my guess is that if he pulls it off, he's going to have to spend all of next week recovering.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's going to be really sore, and he's going to be really, you know, he's going to probably, you know, have to, you know, who knows what the rehab must be for him, like what he goes through. Let's be honest. We really haven't been told exactly what the injuries were to his foot and ankle.
Yep.
You know, you noted the pins and the stuff that he's had to deal with, but like they were never really specific. You know, there's a lot of bones in your foot. You know, that ankle bone, the bone that connects the ankle to the leg. You know, that was allegedly very severely damaged. He's probably going to have some arthritis issues later on. This isn't going to be easy for him in terms of life, let alone just playing golf.
Yep. This is a quote from February 16th. Quote, I'm still working on the walking part. My foot was a little messed up there about a year ago, so the walking part is something that I'm still working on. Working on strength and development in that, it takes time. What's frustrating is it's not my timetable. End quote. Again, we're not talking about February 16th last year. That's February 16th of this year, where he's talking about walking. And now we're looking at this course and him trying to do that. I get the sense that he wouldn't be talking about this if he didn't feel as though there was a good chance to play. Like, game time decision to me, even you said it, he likes to set the bar low, or at least he has, all indications have been him setting the bar low, and here he is saying this. This is kind of almost maybe a little bit of an unfair question to ask you, because you said it, like, we don't even really know what the injuries were, but, and Tiger is such a private guy, we get so many few glimpses into what is actually going on with him, but have you heard anything about the actual rehab itself? Like, what has actually gone on for him over the past, like, 6 months when he's been able to basically really start to recover with this thing? Because, again, 46 years old, to suffer traumatic injuries that involve these kinds of lower body issues, it is pretty... It's confounding to understand how he could even be where he is today.
No, to be honest, he's not really disclosed. The only thing he has said is that, you know, as soon as he was able to get on his feet and to start doing things, he's been doing it. And he said, I don't ever skip a day. And so what that involves exactly, no, I don't know. I mean, has he been in a pool? I know he referenced a treadmill at one time. He said something like, you know, a treadmill is a lot different than, you know, walking on a golf course. You know, you can just imagine he had to kind of just start piecemeal just walking. And I'll be honest, has he, aside from here, when he played 18 holes last week, I wonder if he even walked 18 or 36 holes at home. Like, you know, like you'd think, well, he'd want to try to do it 4 days in a row. You'd think that, but maybe not. Maybe because he's concerned that if he does that, he'd have a setback. And, you know, there's probably some adrenaline that's going to be part of this. So he, you know, he probably figures that that might help get him through a little bit. But to your question about what he actually did, no, I do not know. And that's the thing about Tiger. That kind of stuff doesn't really come out. And that's where we're sort of all guessing here.
I mean, pretty incredible story, whether he actually tees off or not. But you mentioned that this might not have been a reality if it wasn't the Masters coming up, you know, the marquee event of the season, maybe potentially giving him a little bit of a boost here. And you've written about the Phil Tiger dynamic, which, as we mentioned, your book comes out April 26th, and everybody can pre-order it now. How much do you think Phil's win at 50 influenced maybe Tiger Woods' potential return with that whole dynamic and that, you know, obviously competitive nature between the two?
I think that might be in the background. I mean, certainly that's motivating to Tiger. And maybe he's setting his sights on four years from now when he is 50 and he wants to be ready. He wants to be prepared then. You know, I wouldn't doubt it. You know, that's one of the things I tried to capture. It was sort of ironic to me that after all this time, and, you know, Tiger really getting the best of Phil for the majority of their careers, and as great as Phil's career was, you know, it's kind of like half what Tiger did. But, you know, Phil ended up sort of getting the last big one, you know, if it was the last. And to do it at age 50. And, you know, Phil did something at the beginning of his career that Tiger never did, which is he won a tour event as an amateur. And Tiger never came close to that. But Phil did. He won as a junior in college on the PGA Tour, last amateur to win. So, yeah, he has a couple of, you know, some bragging rights over Tiger in that regard. You know, maybe Tiger's not done. And frankly, I didn't think Phil was done necessarily. It's incredible to me that he's not here, because if his game was in shape at all, if he were gunning for this, this is one of the tournaments he could still win, you know, and to not even be playing at the point in time when you don't have that many chances left is really, you know, that's really a shame. I mean, I know why it happened. You know, the reasons are what they are, but the fact that it came to that is really unfortunate.
You mentioned Phil obviously not being there, and it's been a couple peculiar months with Phil and everything that's been going on. Do you think that this was maybe a scenario where he decided to not play at Augusta, or Augusta said, hey, you shouldn't be here?
It's a great question. I mean, I don't think... Unless Phil discloses it, I don't think we're ever going to hear that Augusta told him not to come. Mm-hmm. You know, I just don't think I frankly find that bizarre that they would do that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Mm-hmm. And yet, I don't think they want anybody to know that. And so I think there's a possibility that subtly, you know, between channels, they let that be known. You know, we don't want the distraction. We don't want, you know, we want you to get this figured out first. There's so many parts to this. Was he suspended by the PGA Tour? They've not told us. They usually never disclose discipline, which is frustrating.
Yeah.
Because it would stop us from speculating on it if we knew the answer. And if the Tour suspended him, well, then you could make the leap that the Masters was going to honor it. You know, that they were going to say, okay, look, if they're suspending you, then you shouldn't come here either. But we don't know because they won't tell us. You know, and what's going to happen is after this week and things die down, and if we don't hear anything for a week or two, Phil's supposed to defend his PGA title next month. I mean, is he not going to defend the PGA, this incredible historic win? So, you know, and until he says something or they tell us something, you know, we're going to all wonder about that. And then that story just kind of keeps lingering, this idea that maybe he was suspended. So it's just not great. The whole thing is not great. It's really, really unfortunate.
It's so funny. Whenever people want to poke holes in a conspiracy theory, it's usually, well, how many people would I have to keep the secret? And so you go, yeah, that's true. That's a really good point. There'd be too many people within the government that would have to keep the secret. And then golf exists, right, where they go, no, you'll never know. And you go, okay, kind of believe that we won't. And so maybe
they can talk around it.
Yeah.
You know, like Phil announced a leave. So all the Tour has to do is say, well, he's decided to take time off. Well, maybe behind the scenes they gave him the old wink, wink, nod, nod. Why don't you take some time off? You know, and if you don't, then take the leap. We're going to suspend you. So it's just a bizarre world. I mean, every other sporting league tells you about discipline. And it's, you know, frankly, I think transparency with fans is really important in that regard. But for whatever reason, golf likes to keep its secrets. Like they think that we feel like these guys are, you know, pristine and they never make any mistakes.
Yep. Yeah. Listen, it's funny too, because they've got this Netflix series that's coming out now, right? Like the F1 thing, where they're going to apparently remove a bit of the veil with some of the golfers and show us a little bit more intimacy of, what it's like to be on tour and stuff like this happens. And I go, how could you ever actually have it? Like, the sport is so obsessed with control and the way that they market their players that are we ever going to see something where it is a little bit more human, like what we've seen with the F1 series? I still have my doubts. I just to circle back to one last thing again, we're talking to Bob Harrigan. He wrote Tiger and Phil, golf's most fascinating rivalry. You want to read it. It's coming out April 26th. You can pre-order it right now. I'm fully in on Ailish's theory and the theory that a lot of people have, which is like Tiger wants to get back, or that Tiger at least has in part been motivated by Phil winning at 50, and that he's got to find ways where he can find slights and ways to be motivated, and this is just what more perfect than this. And then there's the idea that he wants to come back, or that he's even rushing this a little bit to stick it to Phil because Phil isn't here. And I wonder if you buy that element of this, where it's like, hey, despite all the stuff that we've seen between the two of them, the match, and the idea that, hey, it was pretty much settled, this rivalry, because as you put it, Phil has done maybe half of what Tiger has over the course of his career, that an element of this for Tiger Woods is still wanting to quote unquote stick it to Phil and make this an even bigger story.
I think that in at least in relation to the Masters right now, I think that might be on the back burner. Because I just think we are talking about such a physical, you know, hurdle to overcome here. But there's no question that Tiger will find motivation in the smallest of things, and always has, in the smallest of slights, even, you know. And you know, it's kind of like Michael Jordan, you know, how he found you know, friction where others might not have seen it and used it as motivation. So I think in general the idea of Phil winning at age 50 motivates Tiger. It's something that he, you know, would love to accomplish himself. I think just the idea of winning again, though, would satisfy that. I don't think it matters where. Let's be honest. If he wins anywhere, it would be incredible. Before this crash, winning again was going to be incredible because of how old he is. You know, guys just don't win a lot at 45, 46 years old. And now he, you know, obviously a whole year was lost or more because of what happened. And, you know, the opportunities are dwindling. But, you know, Tiger just uses that as fuel. And I'm sure, you know, part of his motivation, part of his rehab is to, he wants to get back out here. He says it's not going to be often, but my guess is when he does come out, especially down the road, he'll always be prepared.
Well, with it being Masters Week, I feel like, you know, all we've talked about is Tiger, 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 justifiably. But let's take that out of the equation. And if he doesn't play, what is the secondary story that you're most excited about or interested in going into this week?
I really think the story is that we have a wide open Masters. I just saw a stat yesterday that really kind of struck. Of the 24 Ryder Cup players from September, you know, both sides, Europe and the U.S., there's only one player who has won a tournament in 2022. You know, those are 24 of the best golfers in the world. Obviously, it only includes, you know, those two, you know, the U.S. and then Europe. I mean, it's a lot more than that. But none of them, other than Scottie Scheffler, have won this year. And it just suggests to me that, you know, we've had some sort of ordinary guys win. We've not had the names like John Rahm, Patrick Cantlay, Justin Thomas, Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka. None of those guys have won this year, you know. And Victor Hovland has won. You know what? I might have just blown my own stat there because he was in the Ryder Cup last year. So, still, two out of 24. And the point is I think it's wide open, and I think it's really hard to predict because in past years, too, the Masters winner hasn't necessarily been winning often going in. Like, you don't see many guys win the Masters after winning in Florida. It's just it's somewhat flukish, but, you know, Tiger did that a bunch. Phil has won the Masters after winning the week before. But if you look back, Matsuyama hadn't won in a long time. When Tiger won in 19, he hadn't won that year. In 18, when Patrick Reed won, he hadn't won early in the year. I mean, so I think it's more about a guy who's playing decently but hasn't won. So, and there's a lot of those guys. So it's wide open. That's the story to me. Like, usually we have somebody to seize upon, and I don't know who that person is other than Scheffler, who's won three times in the last 7 weeks, but yet I think that's hard to maintain. I really think it's hard to keep that momentum going, and it takes a lot out of you to be in contention all the time, and especially for a young guy like him who hadn't been there that much.
Well, an exciting week for sure with the Masters coming up. An exciting weekend. We can't wait to see how the Tiger Woods story unfolds, and if not, you know, who in the field can get that green jacket. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Bob, and we'll keep pumping your book. Can't wait to read it when it comes out April 26th.
Hey, thanks, guys. Have a great day. Appreciate it.
No problem. Bob Herrig, Sports Illustrated, and author of Tiger and Phil, Golf's Most Fascinating Rivalry. You can get that on Amazon, pre-order it. Comes out April 26th.